there'll be argument, but you know what? Argument can be a really productive thing.
But if your opinion is a sum total of 20 years of experience having seen a lot of data, then maybe that opinion is a little bit more valuable than the data that is suspect.
Because I think one of the diseases I see in modern business is this belief that there are absolute universals.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Marketing Podcast, episode number 53, is it?
53.
So this is Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett, who you just heard. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing well, actually. Doing well.
So last time when I was introducing the show, I called it the Marketing and Everything Podcast because over the months, and I don't know how long it's been that we've been doing this, the range of topics that we cover has expanded. And occasionally it touches marketing only tangentially. But then we also talked about Regis McKenna and the seminal article that he had in Harvard Business Review called Marketing is Everything. Mm-hmm. And you put the two and two together and say, you know, marketing is everything. So the Marketing and Everything podcast is not such a bad description. So that is the podcast.
Well, and I think what we've discovered is that you start with a marketing issue, neatly isolated. And as you discuss it, you can't help but get into the rest of doing business. And it's not that there's not serious value in, exploring only those other areas. But the reality is you can't market unless you really understand the whole of the business. And that's the other part of what we're running into is you can't be a good marketer without comprehending how does that affect manufacturing and how does that affect engineering and what about finance? And pretty soon you're wandering all over the company. So I think, McKenna's right at some level that marketing is everything. Drucker had a similar kind of observation at one point. What I would say is I don't think it is everything. On the other hand, it touches everything. And so I like the idea of giving ourselves more space to range over the true topics of marketers, which is we end up touching everything.
That's right. And of course, marketing is at the center of an organization. And as a result, does touch everything.
I will say that does require that we be clear that marketing is not only media. And that's the big mistake we see in a lot of businesses where they say, well, we need a marketer. You say, what do you need your marketer to do? And they say, run social media. No, you don't need a marketer. You need somebody to run social media.
Right, right. Okay, so we're not in the rant section of the podcast yet.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I'll withdraw that.
But also from the beginning, we set up this podcast to talk about the concepts behind marketing rather than a tool chest of here's
How do I do this?
Those are also very important. And there are some excellent podcasts and meetups that cover those that are a lot more practical. And they're more of a how-to kind of a podcast rather than conceptual discussion of the topics that drive marketing for business. So with that introduction, we do have a cartoon of the week. And what is the Oon in the Cart?
All right. So this week's cartoon comes to us courtesy Shep Hyken, who is a guy that writes and talks and does speeches about issues in marketing and things like that. And this cartoon has a guy speaking in front of an audience. And on the board, it says, Myth Stakes 101. And somebody raises their hand and it says, Professor, what is a myth stake? And the professor answers, you've probably heard the saying, the customer is always right. It's not true. It's a myth. And underneath, Hyken writes, don't make the myth stake of blindly following business sayings or ideas that sound good, but might be costly mistakes. And I think when I first saw this one and mentioned it to you, I think we both went, God, I love that idea of myth stakes. They're all around us.
Yeah. And of course, I think it's a good hobby within the marketing world to point out what somebody else is doing that's wrong. But also that famous quote that all generalizations are wrong with the possible exception of this one.
That's true. Although I will say the quote that I love that's most related to it is that all models are wrong. Some are quite useful.
Yes, I like that one. I've heard that from you.
Maybe that really does apply with generalizations too, that all generalizations are wrong, but some are quite useful.
Well, they're all, if they're witty, then that has value to me. I do like witty things.
And I think wittiness sometimes helps us get a bit of surprise, gets us to think about something in a slightly different way. And so we'll see. Like when The Customer Is Always Right came out, as you and I were talking, there was a period where people kind of ignored customers. They're like, hey, I'm the guy with the goods. You better pay me.
Right.
So if companies were doing that, then the idea of customers being right was kind of shocking and surprising. It caused them to shift how they thought about things.
Yeah, I think that was an era where customers had suddenly choice that they didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And they were now, the balance of power was shifting from a supplier to the customer. And for you to say customer is always right was another way of saying you better pay attention because they got choices. But I don't think whoever came up with it meant it as a forever big rule.
Yeah, because then it got put into policies and it became a best practice. I don't know if the International Standards Organization has officially released anything about it, but I suspect that they have, or that it's influenced a lot of their work. Because I think one of the diseases I see in modern business is this belief that there are absolute universals, because there aren't. Is the customer always right? What about the always? You need to really pay attention to your customers. And if they express something, they're expressing something significant. And I think you could absolutely say that. Are they right in what they're expressing or in what they're asking for? Maybe not.
There are companies who already score customers according to desirability. Mm-hmm. And if your yield management software tells them how much money they're making off of a customer, and if you're not, then they will not pay attention. And they know what they're doing. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but at least they have a more sophisticated view of when they do or do not want a customer. And we've talked on this podcast about customers that maybe you don't want because they're just going to spend a lot of time and money and not buy anything.
Absolutely. In the services business, you get all those. That, you know, I used to be shocked, and I've mentioned it before a few times, that the people with the least budgets were the most costly because they would have a small budget, and then they wanted you to do this incredible amount of reporting on exactly how the budget's being spent, when the only way to spend a small budget wisely is to turn somebody loose with it so that they can really make use of it. But they were afraid, so they would want us to report every last detail of how we were going to spend the budget. And wanted to evaluate it. And that doesn't work when we're trying to see.
No.
Before we go on to the other mistakes, I think what you and I agreed too is that part of the problem is that they get believed to be universal.
Yes.
Most of these have a sometimes or it depends that goes with them. You know, is the customer always right? It depends. And I think that that's one of the big errors in business in general, is that we try to believe that this is an always statement.
But you know, the business and the culture reward that. And I'm reminded of this scene in a Star Trek episode when Captain Picard and Dr. Crusher have been captured by this alien form, and they have planted a chip in their brains, which allows them to see each other's thoughts. And they break out, and they come to a fork in the road, and Picard confidently says, "That way." And Crusher says, "Jean-Luc, you are not confident of that. You are not sure of that." And he says, "Well, I wasn't, but in my job, you have to be confident," which is like so true. And projection of confidence is like such an important piece. And I think we reward that. And when you reward that enough, you train everyone to jump to conclusions quickly, be more certain than they really are, and reward certainty over vagueness. And of course, everything in life is more vague than not. So that's kind of what you get.
Yeah, the more and more I live, the less I think that anybody should really care about whether they're a decider or not. I mean, there are situations where you need to decide and be firm, and that's an important part of leadership. However, there are also, you know, another important part of leadership is never seen, and that is your ability to not decide. And nobody, you know, kind of points that out and say, "Oh, look at that. They're a great leader because they don't decide." There's a Chinese idea way out of the Tao, which observes that it's important to know how to govern without appearing to govern. And I think that's really true in business, that how do you manage without having to appear to manage? We do so many things for performative reasons as a performance in business, to show that we're on top of things or to show that we're firm and the decider, that actually the smartest management is the one you don't really notice.
Well, you know, speaking of that, we have a saying in marketing that reminds me of that particular statement.
Yes. Tell.
That's the one that says, "Great products sell themselves."
Oh, my God. You know, I wrote a blog post about this once, and my title was "No Product is an Island." You know,
right?
Because right. I do hear, you hear product design people that will say the product is perfectly designed. And if you want to get philosophical, we could go talk about Plato and perfection and what does it mean to be a perfect product? And then we'd have to say, yeah, they don't exist. But okay, if it's perfectly designed, then you don't need marketing. And oh, nothing irritates me more than that, because you always need marketing in some way, in terms of why do people buy? How are they going to learn about it? All those things are absolutely critical, and a product does not do that on its own.
I actually think the sign of excellent marketing is when a product appears to be selling itself. So that was like the invisible part.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? That reminds me, there's an agency, it was an agency, Crispin Porter Bogusky, that did the first advertisements for the Mini Cooper. And I don't know if you remember those, but we had these billboards around, big billboards, and what they featured was a black background and a gorgeous Mini Cooper on it. Now, I knew Crispin Porter's work, and usually the creative got in the way of the product. Somehow, this stuff came around and was executed in a way where you just felt like it was about the Mini Cooper. It wasn't
the product was the star.
Well, because, they made the smart choice of, look at that car, don't you want it? And that was all I needed to be interested in them. I never bought one, but you know, that's what people needed. And that was the key to people buying it. But the fact that they kept their own creativity, in a sense, out of the way, you know, and did creative in a way that enabled the product to thrive. Yeah, that's an example to me of that sense of you want it to not feel like marketing. And those were not easy choices. I'm sure there was a lot that went into the choices that led to those ads.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, they're brilliant. But what about data? Come on, can we talk about this? Let's talk about another mistake, which is everything has to be data-driven. Isn't that true?
No, that's not true. Well, again, as usual, it is true under certain conditions. We've talked about this many times, of course, and that's one of my favorite bad myths because I think you want to be insight-driven. You want to be, what's another good word for insight?
Perception or...
Well, you want to make the right decisions, and data can mislead you, and nothing misleads as well. I mean, you could argue that all misleading is because of wrong data, and even wrong beliefs are because of wrong data. And that's why planes fall off the sky, because it says data's your altitude wrong. Is 200, but in fact, it's 500. And now you do the wrong thing. It's an interesting conversation. Today's world where if I make you believe the wrong thing, wrong data, I can make you do the wrong thing. So I don't need to do it. You do it yourself to yourself. That's kind of the weaponized information world that we live in. So yeah, you want to be data driven as long as the data is accurate, reproducible.
Well, and I'd even argue that I don't think we necessarily do want to be data driven, because this is a great time to pull back to our opening. All models are wrong. Some models are useful. You can actually apply that to data. All data is wrong. Some data is quite effective and quite useful in the sense that all data and all numbers are what I call an abstraction in my book, which means you have to get rid of the real world, kind of like you do in a roadmap. In a roadmap, you can't show every tree, or nobody would ever know how to drive from Portland to the coast. You have to eliminate stuff in order to find your way using a roadmap. Data is the same way. You gather not the real world, you gather a subset of the real world. And if you gather the right subset, it enables you to make really smart choices. But what we tend to forget, and especially with ideas like we need to be data-driven, is that the step to data loses a great deal of the messiness of the real world. And if that messiness is most important, you've actually lost something. And that means that all data is wrong. Sometimes it's quite useful.
The other analogy with data is the drunk man and the lamppost.
Yeah.
The drunk guy has lost his wallet and is looking for it on their lamppost and says, you know, did you lose it here? Says, no, but that's where the light is.
Which is, in a way, I think that's the abstraction, right? The abstraction is you got a lamppost. So you go look at the lamppost. You can't look in the messy real world because you only have a lamp.
You can only see the data that you can see. And that's assuming you even see all the data that you have. But even after that, it just happens to be the data that's collectible. So is it incomplete? Is it irreproducible? Is it incorrect? Is it irrelevant?
Is it instructive? Is it enlightening?
Yeah, exactly.
So
if it has all of those qualities, by all means, be data-driven. It's better than being opinion-driven. But if your opinion is a sum total of, 20 years of experience having seen a lot of data, then maybe that opinion is a little bit more
valid,
valuable than the data that is suspect, right?
Okay, so continuing down, for listeners, Shaheen and I made a big long list of myths. We're not going to be able to cover them all, but we have a lot. So let's talk about the key thing, which is all good marketing must have case studies, right?
Right. Okay, you take this one.
Well, Shaheen, you brought this up, which is the idea that, and you hear it, it's like, well, you need case studies for your software or for your program, and especially in business to business, you hear a lot of this stuff. And it relates to an idea that I ran into with testimonials, because I did a lot of television that had testimonials in it. And everybody would say, well, you have to have testimonials. And so everybody, you know, like the way I'm blaming everybody else, that's not entirely true, but
yeah,
the world primarily goes off and makes testimonials where you get people that are good looking, ready for TV, and they get on TV and they say, I love this product. And my response, and I spend a lot of time with consumers, and I think this is what they would say, is, you wouldn't be in this if you didn't love the product. So tell me something I don't know. And with testimonials, my rule became, we don't care if somebody loves the product. What we want to do is have a real person explain something surprising to us. You know, I used it in this situation. That's a situation like I've got, right? And then I loved it. It enlightens us. It helps us. It moves us along. I think as we talked about case studies, it's very similar that a lot of case studies are written, which is, you know, I bought these the PCs from these guys, and PCs automated our processes. There's nothing there about the people that you bought the PCs from.
Right.
You know, and if the case study is going to matter, it has to matter for your company. So it has to say, I bought PCs from, you know, Bob's Big Boy Computers, whatever they are. I invented that, obviously. And Bob's helped me learn how to do these things with them. And they solved this connection problem we were having. And then they brought another vendor in with us to help, and we're thriving. Because all of a sudden, Bob's is the center of it. You know, the idea that I bought PCs, you know, there's hundreds of sources of PCs. That case study doesn't mean anything unless it's specific and unique to you. And
right. And it exposes some value that you have, or checks off a box that you need to check off. For example, if you're a startup, mm-hmm. you have a brand new product, mm-hmm. the fact that you have a customer at all is important, right? People say, has anybody bought this? And you can say, yeah, so-and-so bought this. And then that's a testimonial, that the case study that is very, very important. But if you're a big PC shop and you're saying people bought my PCs, well, okay. No, but
so what?
Right. Like, I guess the fact that they did is important. You obviously offered something. But that's something may or may not be relevant to me. So you want to expose that. You want to say, we have the best service.
It always depends. You know, it depends on what you need to achieve. The case study needs to deliver on what you need to achieve.
And, right.
You know, more important is your context than merely the fact that you've got a case study. Whether you have a case study or not is immaterial until we look at your context and see how the case study works with it.
That's right. Okay, let's do maybe one more. And do you want to pick one?
Well, let's see. We've already got some of the best there. Oh, God. Well, I'm going to give a quick one. We should probably get out of the way quickly, which is that great office spaces are known because they have jelly beans, espresso machines, and foosball tables. This one particularly gripes me. But anyway, I think there is a lot of that. And you see it especially in marketing and agency worlds. You know, in fact, in the ad agency business, there's a whole thing where people do hot desking in these very coolly designed, wide open places. And I think that a lot of times the agency owners think, well, we're hip because we're doing this and we're different. When you talk to people, they hate hot desking. They have no place to call their own. Every day they come in and they have to sit someplace different. They don't have people that they're with regularly. It doesn't matter how many jelly beans you have, it's not enough to make up for hot desking. So I think that's one I've seen fairly often. We didn't talk about this in the pre-show, but I'm struck by, there's a story about building 20 at MIT, which was somewhat of a dowdy building built in World War II. And through time, it became known as perhaps the most productive place on MIT campus. Radar during the war, the first commercial atomic clock, that really famous photo of a bullet going through an apple was filmed there. And it's like that when they cover it, and yet as a building, it's not the place that any startup wants to be, because apparently it's rambling and it's weird and all these things. Well, the ramblingness causes people from different disciplines to just encounter each other naturally, and a lot of good information passes as a result.
Interesting.
Well, that's weird. I can't really design that into a building. And hot desking doesn't really make that happen, because you put your headphones on and try to ignore everybody around you because they're so noisy.
You know, this reminds me of this tourism. I usually advise folks that if you're doing something, remember what your top reason is, because if you're lucky, you might get it. But you're not going to do this, that, and the other.
Right.
This is all you're going to get if you're lucky. So if you're hot desking because you want to save money, then if you save money, then you achieved your goal.
Right.
And you're not going to make the place more fun or more productive. Those are those are not the top priority. And if you are achieving them too, God, you're like being lucky.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary and lucky. And I think actually, you know, if you go through stories, there's a lot of stories out of kind of a skunk work style operations that just have to put their, nose to the grindstone and do something extraordinarily hard in a very short time. Like there's a project at Data General covered in his book, The Soul of the New Machine.
Yep.
And it also had dingy dungeon-like offices, but the vibe on the project was, we got to save this company. And people pulled off an extraordinary thing. And we tend to forget in marketing especially, we tend to forget that, presentation is not the same as reality. One of the stories about this building at MIT was that your work was clearly most important if you were in that building. The building wasn't more important than your work.
I see.
That building, the building was not more important than your work. Your work was more important than the building. So if you needed a wire between two rooms, you drilled a hole, you ran the wire, and you did the work. And that's part of, I think, why it worked so well and was so productive. People, if you get in a super fancy startup office space, there's kind of a message which is, oh, we're glad you're here doing some work, but how we present it's most important. It doesn't always work that way, but there's a danger.
I think a lot of this comes back to authenticity and the fact that there's really no formula.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what you're doing, who the characters are, what sort of culture has been instilled or is about to get instilled. And if you get it right, then, books are written about you. repeatable so easily.
Can I stretch just one more of these quotes?
Yeah.
Which is, I added late, you haven't seen it necessarily, one from Bill Gates that is on the verge between these things. And it says, your most unhappy customers are your greatest source of learning.
Hmm.
And I think that's a myth stake as well, from the point of view of it depends.
It does depend, yeah.
I've met unhappy customers who are unhappy for their own reasons. We used to take phone calls, oversee phone calls for customers. And we'd have people call in that clearly, sometimes we had a Lonely Hearts Club call in. Oh, the product didn't arrive. I was going out to the mailbox and somebody who obviously needs somebody to talk to. Okay, how much am I learning from that? Not a lot. And, you have to decide how you're going to handle it. You got people who say, well, it doesn't do this perfectly. And you have to decide what they're about. So I think, sometimes they are, pay attention to what people are unhappy about.
Yeah, I think, again, it's good advice, but use your head too, right?
But maybe you would say that Bill has a PR problem. I'm just saying.
Well, something happens and say they have a PR problem. They don't have a problem. They have a strategy problem. They have an execution problem. They have a manufacturing problem. You're not going to communicate your way out of it.
Right. Well, actually, in my marketing class where I have students pick serious problems at companies and try to figure out a marketing plan to solve it, it's taken me a few years before I really got it down, but I now have a way to prevent students from using PR problems as the basis of their stuff, because they would time after time say, and here's one everybody would get, Wells Fargo has a big problem. Oh, what's the problem? Well, they were found liable in this big lawsuit and, they were doing, that's true. How are their revenues? But what do you mean revenues? No. Has it affected their revenues? And what I found with students a lot at times is that there's a perception that if it's bad news, it must be bad for you. which I'm not saying bad news is always good for you, but still, you know, I've, you know, I now immediately challenge anybody with an idea like that with, look, you got to show me numbers. And if there's proof that that's causing them serious business problem, then you can cover it. But if you can't find a serious business problem, that's not valid.
That's right.
We're not going to talk about that. And I've been surprised. I'm probably, you know, 19 out of 20 times, it turns out it's not really causing that much problem.
They absorbed it quite all right.
It's in the headlines, but just because it's in the headlines, the company's absorbing it. They're moving along. People are buying their product at a good rate. Their vendors are continuing to stock the product. Retailers love them. So tell me where the problem is.
That's right. So a couple more, or shall we move to Chicago?
Oh, actually, maybe it would be good to do Chicago sometimes. I'm not sure how many of our listeners have kind of seen the article. Shall we do that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're working, the Chicago Sun-Times put out a summer reading list, and it had the top 10 summer reads. These are the books you should be reading in the summer reading list. Top of the list was Isabel Allende, famous writer. You would expect Isabel to be at the top of the list. And her book, Tidewater Dreams, which apparently is her first climate fiction novel, where, quote, magical realism meets environmental activism, except the book doesn't exist. Now, this is the Chicago Sun-Times, folks. It's in print, and the book doesn't exist. Second on the list is, let's see, The Last Algorithm by Andy Weir. Again, I think I looked at this list because these titles are really, I think I've seen these titles. That book doesn't exist either.
Does any of them exist?
Well, it turned out of the top 10, none of them exist.
Nice.
They were entirely hallucinated. And the Sun-Times, and this is according to Ted Gioia, who Bruce Clark tells me is a wonderful guy to follow, so I've started following him. The he's got a good article on it, and the first 10 books on the summer reading list are entirely hallucinated by the AI.
Amazing.
And then, of course, the Sun-Times said, oh, we tried to do damage control and things got worse. His point is, how did this ever get approved? And, you know, in terms of journalism, the fact it got approved is a very serious problem. Did they trust it because it came from AI? What happened? And I don't think we really know.
No, I don't think we know. Yeah.
But I think it's an interesting, I don't know, warning for us all about how confident AI can sound, as you were talking about confidence earlier.
You know? Well, you know, AI is fundamentally a BS artist. Mm-hmm. So even when it tells you the truth, it's not because it cares about it. It's because it just happens to be true. Now, they are trying to fix that. They are trying to put more of a harness around it and have some kind of a way to ascertain that the data is valid. And they are now putting the reference on the right-hand side. Now, whether or not the reference itself is valid is another question, but they do that. So that means that you can use it if you don't need to be 100% right, if you don't need to be 90% right.
If half right's okay, then maybe you're in fine shape.
And I imagine that probably the first half a dozen times that they tried it, it all worked. I've heard of companies that have applied AI to like 9,000 items, and then they've manually checked the first 900, and it all works. So then they say, okay, by induction, we assume it's all good. But you can't quite assume that, because it could be wrong 105th time or the 2,000th time, and that should... Basically, sometimes that's okay. Sometimes somebody points it out, you fix the bug, no harm done. But you better not run anything mission critical on it.
Well, yeah, if you're submitting legal briefs, don't do it based on the AI.
Somebody did that too, right?
No, we talked about it. Yeah. If you're putting an article in the newspaper, fact check your AI. Go fact check your AI real heavily. If you're going to have it write software to launch your manned mission to Mars, you're in real trouble, actually, on that one, because I think, you know, what I get concerned about is that, like, if you look at the thing called sneak systems, there are situations where airplanes crash doing what they're supposed to. The Boeing 730 crashes were, I think, of that type, where there was software that had bad sensor reading, to make the full circle. And because that sensor reading told it the nose was too high, it pushed the nose down. Now, the pilots fought against it, but they couldn't overcome it. And eventually, the software flew the plane into the ground intentionally doing what it was supposed to do. If you're launching to Mars, I think you'd be better off to have people write your software, because then at least somebody will have touched every part of it in a mindful way, and maybe you'll have a better chance. Those things could still come up, but still.
Well, we're going to have many cases like this with AI permeating everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, in some places, AI is better than the person using it, because the person is using it for something that they don't know how to do.
Well, and that brings us back. We've been talking all along about the fact that it maybe is of most use for experts, because experts are the ones who can detect the hallucinations. And so it might help an expert get along further, whereas a novice is not necessarily going to be able to detect when it's hallucinating.
Right. Very well. So let's do one more of our myths as a positive exit, and then we close.
Okay. Should we go to Walt Disney?
What did he say?
Walt Disney says the way to get started is to quit talking and begin doing.
Oh.
And I like this one because, like the Bill Gates quote, there's truth in it.
Very much, of course. You know? Yes.
But now talk to me about what you hear when you get into that one.
Well, it reminds me of this other one that I hear often, and that is, good ideas are a dime a dozen. It's execution that counts, right? And my reaction is, well, those are not good ideas then, right? Because truly fabulous ideas are quite rare. And truly fabulous ideas are not that hard to execute. That's part of what makes them excellent. Mm-hmm. So I think it depends on what you're doing. I mean, it depends seems to be the theme of this podcast. Mm-hmm. It depends. What are you going to do? And what are we talking about? If talking about, I'm sure he used it in a situation where talking was going around circles and nobody was making progress, and what they were going to do was sufficiently defined. And certainly to go have a minimum viable product was better than just debating it. But in many occasions, that's not the case.
There are times, I mean, what I would agree with, if let's start doing is, well, what if you start prototyping? Sometimes there's real value in saying, okay, we've talked ourselves all around. We got to just try something.
Prototype is always a good idea.
And you go try something and you learn a lot and you move the discussion along. There's a story that Rodin, when he would get stuck while making a little clay model for a sculpture, would every now and then just kind of drop it on the floor and see what happened. Because sometimes you get stuck and you need some things to get going. So I think there's real value in that with Disney. I think actually what I'm getting a little miffed about with business is that there is an anti-thinking thread within business ideas, which is the idea that if you think too much, you're making the wrong move. You know what? Some business issues are extraordinarily tough, and they really have to be thought through with tremendous subtlety and awareness. And so, again, sometimes you really need to keep thinking and sort it out, or keep talking and sort it out. And sometimes you need to begin doing. The judgment call is which is which, and that's a judgment call that we all have to make, if that makes sense.
It does. It's not quite as positive an exit as I was hoping.
Okay, well, let's hire people that are smarter than we are then.
Well, I applaud those who are doing it, but my reaction is, was anybody doing this?
I think that was, I love that. So for listeners, yes, I brought that one up, and he says, what do you mean? Nobody does that, do they? I think the answer is there are people. You know, there's that brilliant book about Abraham Lincoln, about his band of rivals or team of rivals. And it talks about how Abraham Lincoln filled his cabinet with his political rivals because he felt that would get a better result. To have people who had passion and opinions and put them together, there'll be argument. But you know what? Argument can be a really productive thing. You know, in times of uncertainty, and there's no question he was working in times of uncertainty, you need argument. And if nobody's arguing, you're in trouble. And so it does happen. I think it gets used a lot, though, because a lot of speakers get a lot of mileage out of saying it. And, but doing it, more of us need to keep doing it.
That's excellent. Okay, Abe Lincoln, Honest Abe, as a great marketing genius, is a great way to stop.
All right.
Well, thank you, Doug. Thank you all for listening. And we'll see you again next time.
See ya.
That's it for this episode of The Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of Orion X. Thank you for listening.